KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Your argument seems to turn our justice system, in my view at least, into a catch me if you can kind of regime.
The Supreme Court heard oral arguments today on the issue of birthright citizenship. The justices appear divided.
It's Thursday, May 15th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. President Trump traveled to Saudi Arabia this week, joined by tech CEOs.
The Saudis want to build new sectors that are not related to fossil fuels. Technology is one of them.
And our friends from NPR's Shortwave podcast are back with more science news,
including a sensor that could help map safer bike routes.
Can we lower the barrier of entry to cycling by creating a map of where is it safe or unsafe to bike before any accidents actually happen?
Also, back in 1946, Harvard bought an old copy of the Magna Carta for less than $28.
Turns out it's authentic.
That's ahead after news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has met with his Syrian counterpart as the Trump administration begins to wind down sanctions. NPR's Michelle Kalman reports the move is getting bipartisan support in Washington.
Speaking to reporters on a trip to neighboring Turkey, Secretary Rubio says he's just getting to know Syria's new leaders who toppled Bashar al-Assad's regime last year.
We think that a peaceful, stable Syria would be one of the most dramatic improvements in the region in a very long time. And we want to do everything we can to help achieve that.
Rubio says Syrian authorities, who were former jihadi fighters, are promising to build a pluralistic society. They've also asked for help, he says, in removing chemical weapons from the country. The secretary says the U.S. will help with that and will ease sanctions that were put in place during Bashar al-Assad's rule. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
The Supreme Court seems intent on continuing to block President Trump's efforts to restrict birthright citizenship while also looking for a way to scale back nationwide court orders. During oral arguments today, a majority of the court expressed concerns about what would happen if the Trump administration were allowed even temporarily to deny citizenship to children born of some immigrants. Amanda Frost is professor of constitutional law at the University of Virginia.
It would mean that all 3.6 million children on average born every year in the United States, their parents would have to scramble to prove their citizenship. It would no longer be good enough to show the child's birth certificate. And it would cause chaos and confusion, as the lawyers for the plaintiffs argued.
The 14th Amendment says a child born in the U.S. is automatically a U.S. citizen, but President Trump has sought to overturn birthright citizenship. That's been placed on hold by lower court judges. Representatives from Russia and Ukraine hold their first direct peace talks in 3 years. The hopes for any major breakthrough have now dimmed. That's after Russian President Vladimir Putin spurned an offer by Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky for a face-to-face meeting in Turkey. In Los Angeles, the Sheriff's Department has been opening an investigation into Motown legend Smokey Robinson over allegations of sexual assault. Steve Futterman reports.
The announcement of a criminal probe comes a week after a civil suit was filed by four women, all former housekeepers, accusing Smokey Robinson of a series of sexual crimes dating back to 2014. Attorney John Harris represents the women. He outlined the allegations.
Sexual battery, assault, false imprisonment, gender violence, and creating a hostile work environment.
An attorney for Robinson calls the allegations manufactured and says Robinson, who is 85, did nothing wrong. The four women say they did not come forward earlier because of their immigration status. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
On Wall Street, the Dow was up 271 points. This is NPR. When we think of people having their wages garnished for non-payment of student loans, Social Security recipients may not be the first group that comes to mind, but for some older people, it is a reality. While student loan borrowers had their payments and interest halted during the coronavirus pandemic, that is now over, and the federal government says it will restart garnishing the wages of non-payers. Student loan debt among older Americans has grown at a staggering rate. Consumer Financial Protection Bureau says the number of people whose Social Security checks have been garnished is up 3,000% over the past 20 years. Scholars in Britain say a replica of the Magna Carta that Harvard bought nearly 80 years ago for less than $30 turns out to be the real thing and likely worth millions. NPR's Lauren Freyer reports.
The 13th century Magna Carta laid out how the King of England was subject to law, and it's since become the foundation of many constitutions. In 1946, Harvard's Law Library bought what was assumed to be a Magna Carta replica for $27.50. Then 2 years ago, a medieval history professor in London spotted the stained, faded document on Harvard's website. He and others analyzed it using ultraviolet light and spectral imaging and have now concluded it's one of six originals dating back to the year 1300. Others have sold at auction for more than $20 million, but Harvard says it has no plans to sell this one. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
Crude oil futures prices lost ground today amid talk of progress toward a U.S.-Iran nuclear deal that could put more oil on global markets. Oil fell $1.53 a barrel to $61.62 a barrel. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting books, radio, podcasts, film, television, theater, and more to bridge science and the humanities, and the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. The Supreme Court seemed at least partially divided today. Justices heard more than 2 hours of argument testing how the lower courts should handle President Trump's executive order on birthright citizenship. NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg has more.
Trump has long maintained that there is no such thing as birthright citizenship, but the Supreme Court ruled otherwise 127 years ago. The court said then, and since then, that the text of the 14th Amendment, enacted after the Civil War, says that all babies born in the United States are automatically U.S. citizens. Undaunted, Trump, on his first day in office this year, issued an executive order declaring that the children of parents who entered the U.S. illegally or on a temporary visa are not entitled to automatic citizenship. Immigrant rights groups and 22 states sued, and three different federal district court judges invalidated Trump's order, issuing what are called universal injunctions that bar the administration from enforcing the Trump policy anywhere in the country. When the courts of appeal refused to intervene while the litigation proceeded, the Trump administration appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, asking that it block the universal injunctions. The administration asserted that single judges should not have such broad authority. So today, the court heard emergency arguments in the case. The court's conservatives didn't entirely tip their hands. While some of them have called for the abolition of these nationwide injunctions in the past, today they didn't seem so certain, especially after Solicitor General John Sauer opened his argument insisting Trump is right in saying the 14th Amendment has been wrongly interpreted for 127 years.
This order reflects the original meaning of the 14th Amendment, which guaranteed citizenship to the children of former slaves, not to illegal aliens or temporary visitors.
He went on to say that the judges who temporarily barred the enforcement of Trump's policy exceeded their authority under the Constitution. Justice Sotomayor posed this question: if a new president decided to seize all guns in the country, would
we and the courts have to sit back and wait until every plaintiff whose gun is taken comes into court?
Justice Kagan followed up posing this question to Sauer about Trump's executive order, known as an EO.
Let's just assume you're dead wrong. How do we get to single rule of citizenship that is not the rule that we've historically applied, rather than the rule that the EO would have us do?
When Solicitor General Sauer later hedged on whether the administration is committed to abiding by any court ruling, Justice Barrett leaned forward.
Did I understand you correctly to tell Justice Kagan that the government wanted to reserve its right to maybe not follow a Second Circuit precedent, say, in New York, because you might disagree with the opinion?
There are circumstances when it is not a categorical practice.
Justice Kavanaugh asked a series of practical questions.
What do hospitals do with a newborn? What do states do with a newborn?
The federal officials will have to figure that out.
How?
Sauer said they could require documentation showing that the parents are legally in the country. For all newborns, Kavanaugh asked, replied Sauer, we just don't know. Justice Jackson interjected.
Your argument seems to turn our justice system into a catch-me-if-you-can kind of regime where everybody has to have a lawyer and file a lawsuit in order for the government to stop violating people's rights.
When Sauer suggested that litigants could bring class actions instead of individual lawsuits, lawyer Jeremy Feigenbaum, representing the states, responded this way.
I think it's going to hinder the participation in our benefits programs, and I think it's going to produce unprecedented chaos on the ground.
Justice Alito noted that there are 680 district court judges in the country, and if all of them could impose nationwide injunctions, that might produce chaos too. But upon consideration, Alito didn't seem satisfied with Solicitor General Sauer's notion that class actions would be better.
So the answer is that the practical problem would not be solved. And if that's the case, what is the point of this argument about universal injunctions?
Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Gorsuch and Thomas all asked questions skeptical of both sides' positions. So at the end of the day, you just couldn't put a bet on the outcome of the case. A decision is expected by early summer. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
This week in Manhattan, federal prosecutors in the case against hip-hop tycoon Sean Combs have had one of their prime witnesses on the stand. That witness is Cassie Ventura. She was the girlfriend and protege of Sean Combs, who's also known as Diddy. NPR culture correspondent Anastasia Siukis takes a look at the music that Cassie made and how her initial promise was never fulfilled. And a warning, this report mentions physical and sexual violence.
From an early age, Cassandra Cassie Ventura already seemed destined for some kind of stardom. Her debut single, Me and You, exploded when she was just 19 years old. By then, she had already been a successful model for years.
I had remembered her from her Delia's catalog days. And so when her videos began to come out, I said, I know that face.
Hillary Crosley Coker, a cultural journalist and historian, remembers. At the time of Cassie's debut, she was writing about hip-hop and R&B for Billboard magazine. I love you all
the way down. It was a perfect, fun little club song, and you really got the sense that she had the opportunity to do something bigger if she just had the runway to do it.
Me and You soared to number 3 on the Billboard Hot 100 chart. It ended up being one of the biggest singles of 2006. That song and her first album were released by Bad Boy Records, a label co-owned by Sean Combs. Cassie was a newcomer, but her deal with Bad Boy was a stunner. She signed a 10-album contract, a spectacularly long arrangement in the mid-2000s, longer than the ones signed by artists like Rihanna and Britney Spears. Hillary Crosley Coker points out that with a deal of that length, Cassie was going to be tied to Sean Combs artistically, professionally, and financially for many years to come.
Cassie being signed to a 10-album deal at that time in 2006 was very large. And in hindsight, it does feel like a control move as opposed to something that could actually benefit her career. I think at that time, maybe she didn't have representation that could fight back for her or could say, that's a really long time.
Crosley Coker says that at the time, Bad Boy was famous for being controlling in their artist deals. Other artists on the label had agreed to similar terms. Combs had a reputation as a kingmaker. But Cassie never replicated anything close to the success of Me and You. A second single called Long Way to Go made it to number 97 on the Hot 100 and then vanished after just a couple of weeks. I'm gonna tell you what you can. You got a long way to go. Say you wanna love me. Long Way to Go was Cassie's last song to reach any kind of mainstream popularity. This week, Ventura testified that Combs began physically, sexually, and emotionally abusing her in 2007, around the same time that the two of them began dating. That alleged abuse has been at the center of her testimony at Combs's trial this week. On the stand, Ventura said that during her 11-year relationship with Combs, she recorded hundreds of tracks under his direction. But she said that was all just busy work. She said her main job was organizing and participating in multi-day marathons of sex and drug use directed by Combs, which Ventura said happened hundreds of times over the years. Combs's defense lawyers say her participation was entirely consensual, and Combs has pleaded not guilty to all the criminal charges against him. As for her recording career, Cassie went on to release just one more mixtape in 2013, 7 years after her promising debut. Anastasia Tsoulikas, NPR News, New York.
In 1946, Harvard University purchased what it thought was just a very old copy of the Magna Carta from a bookseller in London for $27.50. Now, 80 years later, that document has been identified as the real deal, issued by King Edward I in the year 1300. NPR's Scott Newman has the story.
The first version of the Magna Carta was produced in 1215. It outlined the rights of freemen and the limits of the English monarchy. The Royal Charter of Liberties went through several iterations throughout the 13th century, the last in the year 1300. Although few originals exist today, it's considered one of the most important legal documents in history. Centuries later, that legacy resurfaced when David Carpenter was searching through the Harvard Law School Library's online archives. The professor of medieval history at King's College London saw an item listed as a copy of the Magna Carta from 1327. So he clicked.
And lo and behold, what do I see before my eyes but what for all the world seemed to me an original of the 1300 Magna Carta.
But he needed to be sure. So he enlisted Nicholas Vincent, a fellow professor of medieval history at the University of East Anglia, to help. The two approached Harvard with their hunch and requested an ultraviolet scan to get a better look. Jonathan Zittrain is a Harvard professor who heads the law library there. When he got the request from Carpenter and Vincent, he was intrigued but cautious.
You've got to tie together a number of threads to figure out the authenticity of something. And it's not always that there's a eureka moment where it's like, ah, yes.
Zittrain says that without help from the UK scholars, Harvard may never have known what a great deal they struck all those years ago to own a treasure of world history.
And of course, it makes you wonder, gosh, what else do we have between the couch cushions?
No one knows exactly what Harvard's Magna Carta is worth, but in 2007, one authentic document fetched $21.3 million at auction. Scott Newman, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. It's time now for our Science News Roundup from Shortwave, NPR Science Podcast. I'm joined here in studio by the show's two hosts, Regina Barber and Kwong. Hi, all.
Hi, Juana.
Hey.
So I know that you've brought us three science stories that caught your attention this week. Tell us what they are.
The mutation that makes orange cats orange. And a bike sensor that can help map safer routes.
And the connection between gum disease and heart problems.
Well, I mean, obviously, we've got to start with these orange cats.
Yeah, the greatest cats of all time. That is a fact. According to my orange tabby, Zuko. My blonde orange boy, Benny, also agrees. Maybe not the other three cats. But our boss also has two orange cats, Tang and Dorito. Both of them are males, too.
Guys, I have to tell you something. I also have an orange cat. And guess what? Also a boy.
Okay, this is perfect because approximately 80% of orange cats are males. And it's something researchers and cat enthusiasts have long noticed. Scientists suspected the reason may be that orange color is a sex-linked trait, meaning the mutation responsible for that ginger hue is found on their sex chromosomes, specifically their X chromosome.
Male cats, just like male humans, have an X and Y chromosome. So any male cat with this mutation ends up orange. Female cats need the mutation on both of their X chromosomes to be fully orange, which is statistically less likely. So nearly all calico and tortoiseshell cats are female because this mutation is found on only one of their X chromosomes.
Interesting. So were they right? Was the mutation on the X chromosome?
Yes. They found the mutation. They found its location. It's a single deletion on the X chromosome, which causes a nearby gene to be expressed in pigment cells, so cat hair color. This mutation was independently located by two teams of scientists, one led by Hiro Sasaki in Japan and another by Chris Kalin at Stanford University. Both papers were published in the journal Current Biology this week.
So no orange cats were harmed in the pursuit of this genetic mystery.
Well, that's good.
In fact, study author Greg Barsch says that the Stanford team partnered with cat lovers and community scientists to gather DNA samples from dozens of different orange cats.
It's an example, I think, of how scientists and the public can work together to not only uncover cool things, but also learn important aspects about biology.
Interesting, but what about other orange animals like tigers or orangutans? Mm. Are their orange colors linked to their sex chromosomes too?
So actually, no, their orange color arises from regular chromosomes known as autosomes.
Proving what we always knew, orange cats really are that special.
They're so special. We all know this. And in case you were wondering, all orange cats do share the same mutation, meaning, Juana, there was a first orange cat.
Love that. All right, let's move on to the next one and talk about sensors on bikes. I know standard bikes do not have them, but scientists are making these to help those of us that bike not get hit by cars.
Yes, Juana. I just bought a bike. I just started biking. I don't want to get hit by a car. Mm-mm. So I was very interested in the study where, like, computer scientists created a system called Proxy Cycle. It's a sensor to monitor how close cars get to cyclists. The scientists deployed the sensor on 15 bikes over the span of 2 months in Seattle, Washington.
So this bike sensor costs less than $25 to make. It attaches to the left handlebar. And in this study, these 15 cyclists took 240 rides with the sensor and recorded over 2,000 close passes, though thankfully no collisions. And the researchers presented these findings at the Conference on Human Factors in Computing Systems in Japan.
Okay, so other than terrifying these bike riders, and to be clear, this sounds absolutely terrifying, what did these cars zooming too close to the riders tell researchers?
Interestingly enough, Seattle has collected bike collision data for the last 20 years, and this study compared 5 years of that data to the research team's 2 months of close passes, and the data sets match pretty well. This tells us that close passes, so when a car comes close to a bike, that might be a good indicator of your chances of an actual collision in that section of the road.
And that might seem like an obvious connection. connection to make, but the lead researcher, Joe Breda, at the University of Washington has surveyed cyclists and found that people who were like new to city biking weren't all that good at like gauging how safe routes were. Mm-hmm. And that's where the sensor could help. Like, he just wants to encourage more people to bike.
Can we lower the barrier of entry to cycling by creating a map of where is it safe or unsafe to bike before any accidents actually happen?
Okay, right, that map. You said the sensor might be helpful in mapping safer bike routes, which would be super helpful, but how would it work?
Joe says the next step is to deploy these sensors in more cities on more bikes. He also wants this to be accessible to as many people as possible, perhaps by making the software and design eventually open source.
And you know, Juana, we've gotten so used to like maps when we're driving, like people's devices telling companies like Google where traffic is, allowing them to reroute themselves. Imagine something like that for cyclists, where all of this like crowdsourced data from the sensors can feed into a map that helps like find safer bike routes.
I mean, that does sound pretty incredible.
Agreed.
The power of science.
Indeed. All right, last story of the day. There is a connection between gum disease and heart health?
Yes. So people with gum disease could have a higher risk of heart failure or stroke, which we've known, but a recent study in the journal Circulation offers even more insight on the gum disease heart connection, and specifically the link between gum disease and atrial fibrillation.
I watched too many medical shows, so I know this one. That's AFib, right? Like an irregular rapid heart rhythm.
Right. AFib is common, affecting about 10 million U.S. adults. And now AFib isn't necessarily life-threatening, but it can be dangerous, especially for older people. And gum disease is also really common. It affects nearly half of U.S. adults.
I did not know that. So tell us, how are they connected?
Well, this topic was a special interest to one of the study authors, Shunsuke Miyauchi. He's a cardiologist at Hiroshima University in Japan. Both his parents happen to be dentists. Mm. So even though Shunsuke works with hearts, he said he's always paid attention to people's oral care.
To study the connection, his team infected mice with a bacteria associated with gum disease and found that these mice developed aphid more easily than those without the bacteria. Mm-hmm. They also saw that mouth bacteria migrated to the heart, like in mice and in humans. Hmm.
Though David Wu at the Harvard School of Dental Medicine, who wasn't involved with the study, says the way the mice were infected with the bacteria could have made it easier to spread through the bloodstream.
Still, like, once the bacteria reaches the heart, the study authors think it may lead to tissue scarring or inflammation, which may contribute to all sorts of other problems, like AFib.
That's really interesting. So I wonder, does this just mean we should all be taking extra special care of our teeth, brushing more, brushing better?
Yes. Elizabeth Jackson is a cardiologist at University of Alabama at Birmingham, and she was not involved in the study, but she said it highlights the importance of like good dental care and like healthy living overall, like exercise, healthy food.
We know that all the things that help reduce inflammation are good for the heart. And they clearly are good for other parts of us.
Everyone we spoke to hopes this study encourages greater collaboration between dentistry and medicine to keep people's gums and hearts healthy.
That's Emily Kwong and Regina Barber from NPR's science podcast Shortwave, which you can follow for new discoveries, everyday mysteries, and the science behind the headlines. Thanks, both of you.
Thank you, Juana.
Is NPR News.
Federal judges have blocked President Trump's executive order to impose strict limits on birthright citizenship. A groundbreaking Supreme Court case could determine the scope of presidential power. Plus, author Ron Chernow unearths the history and tragedy behind the writer of Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn, Mark Twain. Those stories tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ilse Chang. President Trump is traveling in the Middle East.
He repeated the idea that the United States should take over and develop Gaza.
I think I'd be proud to have the United States have it, take it, make it a freedom zone.
More on the president's trip after this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. The Pentagon is reviewing a request from the Trump administration to use National Guard troops for the first time to help crack down on illegal immigration. The Department of Homeland Security requesting some 20,000 National Guard troops. NPR's Tom Bowman says the White House is frustrated with staffing shortages at agencies that oversee immigration enforcement.
There's no sense at this point what role the Guard troops would play. It might be providing transportation or security, or if they would be detaining migrants or actually maybe taking part in arrests. Back in February, Texas Governor Greg Abbott gave Texas Guard members the authority to make immigration arrests. Now, this would be the first time Guard troops at the national level, a widespread effort, have been asked to assist in deportations.
That's NPR's Tom Bowman. The Pentagon is now reviewing that request. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says he doesn't have high expectations for talks in Turkey on ending Russia's war in Ukraine. Russia decided to send a low-level delegation, as we hear from NPR's Michelle Kellerman.
Secretary Rubio says President Trump is impatient and wants the war to end, but the Kremlin balked at the idea of high-level talks with Ukraine, so now Rubio is talking about a one-on-one between Presidents Trump and Vladimir Putin.
I think he's ready to have that engagement and determine once and for all if there's a path forward and what that path is. And it's my assessment that I don't think we're going to have a breakthrough here until the President and President Putin interact directly on this topic.
Rubio sounded disappointed that the Russians sent a low-level team to Turkey, so he doesn't expect much to come out of the talks in Istanbul. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
It was a mixed day for stocks on Wall Street after consumers spent more money last month to get ahead of new import tariffs. This is NPR. In Missouri, months after voters placed protections for abortion rights in their state constitution, Republican lawmakers are preparing to ask if they've changed their mind. From St. Louis Public Radio, Jason Rosenbaum reports.
Missouri Republicans like Senator Adam Schnelting want to repeal a measure that legalized abortion up to fetal viability and replace it with a ban with exceptions for medical emergencies and rape and incest up to 12 weeks of pregnancy.
Missouri's women need the protections that are contained in this bill. Missouri's babies, Missouri's children.
But during a rally on the Missouri Capitol steps, speakers such as Nancy O'Brien said they were prepared to defend protections voters already support.
Every Missourian deserves to have agency and control over their own body.
Missourians will likely vote in 2026 on whether to ban most abortions or keep abortion rights protections. For NPR News, I'm Jason Rosenbaum in Jefferson City.
Cyber hackers have stolen the customer information of the largest site cryptocurrency exchange in the U.S., demanding $20 million not to publicly release that information. The CEO of Coinbase, Brian Armstrong, says the hackers were able to bribe some of the company's customer service agents who turned over data, including names and birth dates. Armstrong says Coinbase will not pay the ransom. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station And from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Cunard, with round trips from Miami to the Caribbean on Cunard's Queen Elizabeth, guests can dine on flavors of the Caribbean and explore local life on shore in Antigua, Barbados, St. Lucia, and beyond. Learn more at cunard.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. When President Trump went to Saudi Arabia this week, he brought along a number of top tech CEOs, among them the heads of OpenAI, NVIDIA, and Amazon. These executives announced a flurry of artificial intelligence investments, signs of renewed relationships between Saudi Arabia and Silicon Valley after years of tension. NPR's Bobby Allen joins us now to explain what has changed. Hi, Bobby.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, so why did so many tech executives decide to personally join Trump in Saudi Arabia, you think?
Yeah, you know, it's a symbolic way of saying the U.S. tech industry is moving beyond the killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Back in 2018, after the country's agents killed Khashoggi, there was a backlash, right? Many tech companies refused to attend this big summit there known as Davos in the desert. There was new scrutiny of tech ventures funded with Saudi money. And here we are 7 years later, Elsa, and the Silicon Valley elite are no longer debating Saudi's human rights record. Instead, they are gladly striking new deals with the country. And they're doing so just as tech CEOs embrace President Trump, which is a far cry from his first term when Trump and the tech world were very much at odds.
Exactly. So what does the tech industry get from Saudi Arabia specifically?
Well, the tech industry, you know, for them, the obvious thing is money. The Saudis have invested billions of dollars to support AI development in the U.S., and this week they're promising even more. Now, on top of this, Princeton professor Bernard Haeckel told me there are three other things that are maybe less obvious that Saudi Arabia can offer.
Land for data centers, two, free energy, and three, a very low to non-existent regulatory environment.
Right. Haeckel says a lot of cheap land where companies can build data centers and power energy-intensive AI infrastructures is appealing to tech companies competing fiercely in the AI race, as is, Elsa, a society where there are just fewer guardrails and constraints for AI development. And another factor, the Saudi alliance is being pitched by industry leaders as a way to keep China's tech at bay.
Of course. Well, what about Saudi Arabia? Like, why did they want these particular deals so much?
Yeah, Haeckel, who actually communicates regularly with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, told me, you know, recent AI investments and this cozying up to Silicon Valley has been in the works for some time.
The Saudis are involved in a very serious effort to diversify their economy away from oil, which they're heavily dependent on, and petrochemicals. And they want to build new sectors that are not related to fossil fuels. Technology is one of them.
For example, the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund says it has invested more than $100 billion in the U.S. since 2017, and now Trump is calling on the country to pour another $1 trillion in. Unclear how serious that is. One thing Haeckel says is certain is that Saudi officials are pleased that the U.S. business community's icy relationship with the country is thawing because he says its economic future depends on it.
Okay, but are there concerns about this growing relationship between big tech and Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, human rights organizations question whether it's really a smart idea to do business with an authoritarian regime where, say, being LGBT is illegal and can lead to prison time. Dissent is repressed. The country has little tolerance for free speech. Then there are the national security fears, right? That giving Saudi Arabia access to the U.S.'s leading AI technology could one day create competition and security problems.
That is NPR's Bobby Allen. Thank you, Bobby.
Thanks, Elsa.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Capital One. With the Capital One Saver Card, what's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com.
Part of President Trump's self-described big, beautiful bill includes congressional Republicans' plans to change Medicaid. The proposal would cut billions from the safety net program. Many Republican lawmakers see this as a needed way to slash what they see as waste in the system, but recent estimates show that millions of Americans stand to lose their health insurance, including in Republican-held districts. Joshua Yeager from member station KVPR brings us this report.
A large crowd of protesters gather outside Kern Medical Hospital in Bakersfield, California. Some sit in wheelchairs, others wear lab coats.
all agree that meaningful cuts to Medicaid would be a disaster for this region. The hospital sits in a swing district held by Republican Congressman David Valadao. His stretch of the rural Central Valley also has the highest number of Medicaid patients represented by a House Republican. Nearly two-thirds of residents here, according to research by UC Berkeley.
Here in Bakersfield, I've seen some of the sickest patients that I've ever seen in my training so far.
Megan Howland is an OBGYN and resident in her second year at the hospital.
Patients that, you know, for the first time are coming to the hospital, delivering their baby with no prenatal care, no medical care, that are often very high risk.
She says a whopping 90% of her patients are enrolled in Medicaid, which provides free health insurance to low-income Americans. Many are immigrant farm workers who pick and process the San Joaquin Valley's agricultural bounty. In California, more than 1 million immigrants currently have Medicaid coverage. This week, Governor Gavin Newsom proposed freezing enrollment to immigrants in the state who do not have legal status. Howland's patients face other challenges as well, she says. Some battling drug addiction, others homelessness.
The thought that our already marginalized population could lose access to that very basic resource is frightening for me, and it worries me that these already sick patients are not going to have the care that they need to be able to take care of themselves.
Ulysses Hernandez is one of those patients. He's physically disabled and relies on a motorized chair to get around.
If these cuts were to happen, families, people with disabilities like myself, would have a harder time to decide what's more important for us, rent, food, or medical insurance.
Approximately 70 million Americans are enrolled in Medicaid nationwide. The current GOP proposal would cut at least $600 billion from Medicaid over the next decade. It would accomplish this mainly by implementing new work requirements.
All of this is part of our effort to strengthen Medicaid for the people that need it most.
Republican Congressman Brett Guthrie leads the House Energy and Commerce Committee, which oversees Medicaid's budget. He says the party is targeting waste, fraud, and abuse. Recent estimates from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office say about 10 million Americans would lose their coverage under the GOP's Medicaid bill. And that could harm vulnerable Republicans like Valadao, whose constituents overwhelmingly rely on the program to cover doctor's appointments and prescriptions.
My goal is to not do anything that damages Medicaid and what they deliver for our constituents.
Valadao has pledged to preserve Medicaid in recent interviews like this one with local TV station KBAK. But Valadao agrees with his party's leadership on at least one point.
I know you hear it a lot, waste, fraud, and abuse, but there are people who are registered in multiple states. There are people who are on the program that shouldn't be on the program.
Valadao's office declined an interview request with NPR, citing a packed schedule. His team also didn't get back to us when we asked whether Valadao would support the GOP's newly proposed cuts. Whatever his decision, it's almost certainly one that voters will remember when they head back to the polls next year. For NPR News, I'm Joshua Yeager in Bakersfield.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. New academic standards in Oklahoma call for the teaching of, quote, discrepancies in the 2020 election results, even though these baseless claims have been repeatedly refuted. Beth Wallace of State Impact Oklahoma reports.
Oklahoma's new academic standards have been championed by Ryan Walters, the state superintendent of public instruction and a conservative firebrand.
These new standards will ensure that kids have an accurate and comprehensive view of historical events while also reinforcing the values that make our country great.
Quietly included at the last minute were standards instructing students to, quote, identify discrepancies in 2020 election results, including the sudden halting of ballot counting in key battleground states. There was no sudden halting of counting, and courts and audits reaffirmed the election results. When the Oklahoma State Board passed the standards, new members said there wasn't enough time to adequately review them. In April, the state legislature declined to block the standards. And while Republicans have raised concerns about the state board's rushed process, the content of the standards has gotten little pushback from the majority party. Here's Oklahoma's House Speaker Kyle Hilbert.
I think that students should be challenged to think critically about that particular election and what led to that high turnout, as well as all the reforms that you saw states pass in the wake of that.
But others say critical thinking is not what the standards prescribe students to do. Tammy Patrick is the CEO for programs of the Election Center. She objects to the standards' mention of batch dumps of ballots. She says without a conversation about how late night counts are standard operating procedure, it is a recipe for misunderstanding.
That is not teaching critical thought. Teaching critical thought is to frame it in such a way that instructs the students to find something that sounds odd to them, and then to dig deeper into why is it the case that the thing that sounds strange to you, when you put it into context, is it still odd?
Patrick says false claims about the election have eroded public confidence in the system.
And it will continue to erode if we continue to have these false narratives being repeated continually and used in an academic setting as though they are truth and fact.
If I'm assigned to a specific course, my charge is to teach those standards.
That's Aaron Baker, an Oklahoma City high school government teacher. Because the standard is for U.S. history, he won't teach them in his classroom. But he says if he had to, he would include a fact check.
I would have no qualms at all about telling my students, in fact, I've been telling my students for 4 years, that the courts have declared over and over again, multiple times, that there was not widespread voter fraud in the 2020 election.
It's unclear how teachers will integrate the standards next school year, but a lawsuit filed by a former GOP Oklahoma attorney general could stall their implementation. Like other Republican criticisms, the lawsuit is critical of how the standards were approved, not the standards themselves. For NPR News in Tulsa, I'm Beth Wallace.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ailsa Chang. President Trump has not talked about the conflict in Gaza very much during his trip to the Middle East. But this morning, he once again said that he does think the U.S. should take over Gaza and develop the Strip as a freedom zone. He made his comments in Doha, and the comments come as Israel intensifies its campaign in Gaza, with strikes killing more than 150 people there in just the past day.
Gaza has been a territory of death and destruction for many years. And, you know, I have concepts for Gaza that I think are very good. Make it a freedom zone. Let the United States get involved and make it just a freedom zone.
NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez is traveling with the president. He joins us now from Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates. Hi, Franco.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, so the war in Gaza is obviously the biggest active conflict in the Middle East right now. Why do you think Trump has not been talking about it more while he's in the region?
Well, I mean, he has spoken generally about wanting to broker peace on this and other conflicts on the trip. But today really was the first time that he went into specifics while speaking at a business roundtable forum in Doha. And he was blunt.
I'd be proud to have the United States have it, take it, make it a freedom zone, let some good things happen, put people in homes where they can be safe, and Hamas is going to have to be dealt with.
You know, there's been little progress in talks for a ceasefire, even after the last living American hostage was released. And Israel is also, as you know, planning a major new offensive after Trump leaves.
Well, what have the various leaders whom Trump has been visiting been saying about the conflict?
I mean, they've been pretty quiet about this as well. I mean, they don't like Trump's proposal. But in many ways, they also want to avoid this topic while he's here. I mean, they're showering Trump with all these lavish ceremonies and announcing big dollar investments. It's because they want to build global credibility. And they also want to kind of insulate themselves in the event that Trump tries to pressure them to take some action on something that they don't want, whether it's Gaza or something else in the region.
And today I understand that Trump went to Al Udeid Air Base outside Doha. What was that occasion like?
You know, so it felt very much like a campaign stop, but I was surrounded by military helicopters and service members. Trump delivered a very political speech. He actually called the Biden administration evil. He said the troops were, quote, making America great again, you know, using his campaign slogan. You know, he walked onto the stage in his campaign music. He walked off the stage to his campaign music. And, you know, presidents generally try to make speeches to troops apolitical, especially when they're overseas. So this was pretty unusual.
Yeah. Well, also, I saw that Trump visited a mosque today when he landed in the UAE. How significant do you think that is?
Very. I mean, it's believed to be the first time he's ever visited a mosque during his time in public office. It's a sign of respect to his hosts and their religion after days of getting a red carpet treatment. And also, it's kind of a nod to how he's tried to repair relationships with the Muslim community in America.
That is NPR's Franco Ordonez in Abu Dhabi. Thank you so much, Franco.
Thank you.
The Henyo are a group of South Korean women, mostly elderly, who dive in frigid ocean waters almost every day to fish. A new study reveals the adaptations that make that superpower possible. NPR science reporter Ari Daniel has more.
In this video, a motorboat chugs along near Jeju, an island some 50, 60 miles off the coast of South Korea. Before the vessel even comes to a stop, an older woman in a wetsuit, fins, and mask steps into the water. Two others follow her. These women belong to a long line of female free divers on Jeju Island called the Henyo, who rely on nothing more than holding their breath to stay underwater for as long as 2 or 3 minutes at a time. They swim off, each with a net bag in tow, to collect seafood to eat and sell.
Things like abalone, sea urchins, you know, harvest seaweed sometimes.
Melissa Alardo is an evolutionary geneticist at the University of Utah. She recorded that video of the Henyo, who routinely dive in waters that she says are 50 degrees at best.
One of the first times I was there, it was snowing. They said as long as there's not a risk that they're going to be blown away to sea, then they still go out in the water, no matter how cold it is.
The women start diving as girls and continue well into old age across all of life's milestones. Diana Aguilar-Gomez is a population geneticist currently at UCLA.
They dive throughout their whole pregnancy. They say they just dive until basically before they give birth.
And then they were back in the water 3 days later.
Yeah, it's amazing.
The question that Melissa Alardo had was how the Henyo are capable of enduring such an extreme lifestyle.
How evolution might have shaped the Henyo to be better divers, to dive more safely, to dive for longer.
So she decided to compare the Henyo to other elderly women on the island who aren't divers but have a similar genetic background, and to still others off-island who aren't related, about 30 in each group. But here's the thing.
You can't take 70-year-old women who have never been diving and, you know, throw them in the open ocean.
Fortunately, there's a workaround, a simulated dive.
You hold your breath and put your face in a bowl full of cold water, and your body responds as if you're diving.
The Henyo found it a little silly, but their response was clear. Their heart rates fell by about 50% more than their non-diving peers.
We had one diver whose heart rate dropped over 40 beats per minute in 15 seconds.
Ilardo says the Henyo response is due to a lifetime of training, classic physiological adaptation. Next, the researchers took saliva samples to look for genetic differences. Everyone from Jeju, both the Henyo and the non-divers, had basically the same genes.
What this suggests is that everybody in Jeju has an equally likely chance of being a descendant of a diver.
Two genes stood out. The first was one that seems to be related to cold tolerance.
Maybe that protects them from hypothermia.
The second gene was associated with blood pressure, says Diana Aguilar-Gomez, likely connected to blood vessel structure and function.
Diving increases your blood pressure, and particularly through pregnancy, that can be very dangerous. It can increase your risk for preeclampsia.
And other potentially life-threatening complications.
Even if you didn't die, like probably women that would protect it against this would be more likely to have more children.
And more likely to pass their genes along. Melissa Alardo thinks the low stroke mortality on Jeju Island could be related to this second protective gene.
Wouldn't it be amazing if, by studying divers in Korea, we can translate these findings to develop a therapeutic that protects people from stroke around the world?
The results are published in the journal Cell Reports. Stephen Chung studies extreme physiology at Brock University in Canada. He wasn't involved in the research, which he finds fascinating.
By pushing the body to its limits, we get a better sense of where those limits are, but also just what the human body is capable of.
Melissa Alardo says we have much to learn from the Henyo and what makes them, in her words, extraordinary. Ari Daniel, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs. With online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. And from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers.